been an education instructor for Harvester
for the last 4 or 5 years as well. Really hoping that we can continue what all you good folks have been doing with giving opportunity for both quality and opportunity for hunting and fishing in the state of Utah. Thanks.
Gene Boardman, I'm from Hinckley, Utah, and I represent the public at large.
Brian Johnson from Enoch, Utah, non-consumptives. I like long walks on the beach. I lick a few rocks here and there.
Braden Richmond, represents Sportsman from Beaver, Utah.
Kevin Bunnell, I'm the regional supervisor for the Division of Wildlife Resources in the southern region.
Wade Heaton from Alton, Utah. I represent the public at large.
Berlin King from Bicknell, Utah. I represent agriculture. I'm happy to be here to serve on this board. I'm one of the new guys. I'm a fifth-generation rancher. I run a herd of cow, 400-head cow-calf operation. 3 generations of that have been in the Wayne County, Garfield County area, wintering on the Henry Mountain, or at the base of the Henry Mountains, and then summering either up on the Boulder or on private land. I'm 58 years old. I'm also a veterinarian. I've practiced since 85. We moved back in 88. My wife and I run the clinic and the ranch. I'm happy to be here on the rack to serve and provide input from the agricultural part of it. Thank you.
Rusty Aiken from Cedar City, representing public at large.
Craig Lobb from a farm in Iron County, representing agriculture.
Mike Worthen, Iron County, I represent public at large.
Tammy Pearson, from the looks of things, I'm from the Babysitters Club. You got to have one designated woman to keep track of all the men, right? No offense. You guys will get used to me. I born and raised in Millard County, been in Minersville and Beaver County since 83. We run cattle, got a 600-head cow-calf operation. Got smart a few years ago, got rid of the dairy cows, but we've still got about 600-800 acres of farm ground. Grew up farming, ranching on both sides of my family, born and bred in me. Been hunting my whole life. Back on the Sheep Rocks was where our family was from, and our ranch. And back before they had deer tags, my mom told me. So our family's big claim to fame is my grandmother shot a 42-inch deer, 5-point back in 49, and it's in the record books. That's the one, and well, we have a few good ones, but nobody can compare to grandma's. So I'm actually Beaver County Commissioner, and I represent the elected officials, I guess.
Thank you. We do need somebody to look after us. I'd also like to recognize two of the wildlife board members that we have with us this evening. We have Donnie Hunter and Steve Dalton that are here. We appreciate them. Maybe just to start off with, if you're new to the RAC process, we do have comment cards. If you want to come to the microphone after a presentation with comments, you need to fill out one of the cards and give those to one of the personnel in brown, and they'll bring those up to us. The biggest thing is we'll have a a time period for questions following a presentation, and we want to make sure that that is limited just to questions, and then if you have a comment, you need the comment card, and we'll give you up to 5 minutes for a comment on that. The first action item that we have, number three on the agenda, would be to approve the agenda and the minutes. I assume that you guys have had a chance to review those. If there's not any discussion, I'd entertain a motion to accept those.
So moved.
Okay. We have a motion from Wade.
Second.
Second from Braden. All those in favor?
Aye.
Looks like that's unanimous. So then, item number four, I'll give a brief update from the last Wildlife Board meeting. If you recall, there was just the two action items that we discussed. There's an upland game and turkey hunt table recommendations, and those passed unanimous as they did in our RAC. And then the big item was the falconry rule amendments. And if you recall, there was quite a bit of discussion on that. And the way this turned out was, I think, is a good example of how important the RAC process is. As this evolved through each of the RAC meetings, the DWR was there and could see where this was going. And by the time it got to the board, the presentation was pretty much such that they accepted the recommendations from the falconers, and they were ready for that, and it was a good process to see and to go through. And so they accepted the recommendations as we did in our meeting, so that was good. I'll turn the time over to Kevin for a region update.
Thanks, Dave. Two things. I'm going to spend most of my time kind of giving an update on the Bryan Head fire and what the impacts to wildlife there have been, and what the plans are for rehabilitating the burned area. But before that, I think most of you are probably aware we do have a new director for the Division of Wildlife Resources. Greg Sheehan was recruited back to Washington and is a deputy director of the Fish and Wildlife Service and is the acting director of the Fish and Wildlife Service in Washington. Mike Fowkes, who was our deputy director, was an interim director for 2 months, but then just earlier this week or late last week, sometime in the last few days, Mike was named as director of the Division of Wildlife Resources by Mike Styler, who's our DNR director. So we look forward to Mike's leadership. He's indicated to us that he doesn't plan on changing course. The agency is headed in a good direction following Greg's leadership, and we'll probably continue in a similar vein to that. With the Bryan Head fire, and I'll run down some information here, and then if there's any questions, I'll do what I can to answer them. The total burned area was 72,000 acres, so it was quite a large fire. Of that 72,000 acres, 60% of it was classified as either moderate or high severity, meaning that it burned hot and burned rather completely in some of those areas. A lot of that 60% will require rehabilitation or some efforts to go back in to recover the habitat there. Immediately after a fire like this, there's a group that's called the Burned Area Emergency Response, or BEAR, that gets together and puts together an initial request for funding to start rehab. That has already been funded at $3.8 million. With that $3.8 million, the Forest Service will treat some of the worst areas. Just over 3,000 acres will be, and a lot of it's places that are where they're concerned with human health and safety, or there's infrastructure that's at risk, and a lot of it's at soil stabilization as well. The only lasting impact of the fire that may impact the hunting public and recreationists for the summer is that the Yankee Reservoir area, the roads up there remain closed. So the Let me get this right. So first and second left-hand forks, it's a loop that goes up around the Yankee Meadows area. That road is currently closed and will probably remain closed at least through the archery season. We're anticipating it may be open for the muzzleloader and rifle seasons. But second left-hand fork is probably going to remain, will remain closed just because it's impassable. The road in second left-hand fork has been washed out with debris flows, and I don't know how long it will take them to go in and rehab that. In addition to the funding that came through the Forest Service, the Division of Wildlife and Forestry, Fire, and State Lands have gone back to the legislature and asked for some emergency funding for fire rehab. The request is for $5 million for all the fires throughout the state. About half of that will probably come to the Bryan Head Fire. With that, in addition to the 3,000 acres that the Forest Service will be treating here, and that will begin in the next couple of weeks, we will work to rehabilitate an additional 15 to 20,000 acres with around $2.2 million. And that'll be in the form of seeding and mulching and maybe some chaining in some of the lower areas where we had pinyon and juniper that was burned. We've prioritized the areas to treat based on deer habitat, sage-grouse habitat, areas that are less than 40% in slope, and then we've prioritized any place that isn't dominated by aspen. Aspen communities will come back on their own and really don't need much in the way of rehabilitation to come back and to make good wildlife habitat. In addition to that, we'll probably be doing work in that fire area for the next 3 to 5 years, as that mountain responds after the fire. Probably our biggest concern from a wildlife standpoint from the fire is what it has done and will continue to do to our aquatic resources. So far, Panguitch Lake and Red Creek reservoirs are holding fish, but we have had some minor fish kills in both of those reservoirs. Impacts from ash flows and the nutrient loads that come as a result of those ash flows could severely impact both of those reservoirs, but so far they're holding up, and we're hopeful that they'll be able to that we won't have widespread fish kills. We fully expect to lose the fish in Yankee Meadows Reservoir. That the basin around Yankee Meadows was burned very completely and very hot, and we'll have to go in after the fact and bring those resources back. And it's pretty likely that we'll lose the fish in Red Creek Reservoir or Paraguna Reservoir. We're concerned about nutrient loads in Panguitch Lake, and part of that's due to the fact that Panguitch Lake is a natural lake, so there's a natural lake basin that's below the dam structure that we're unable to pull water out of the lower levels of that lake, and so those nutrients accumulate in the lower portions of that lake, and right now we don't have any way to flush them out. And as that continues to build up, we're worried specifically about phosphorus levels and algae blooms that could result from that. We are, with the money that we requested from the legislature, we're hoping to get some engineering work done to try to design a way that we can pull some of that water out of the lower levels of that lake and flush that nutrient load out and make that a healthier lake going forward. But we're not quite sure how that will work or what we're going to have to do to make it work, but it's something we're working on, and we will find a solution to. Probably the biggest impact has come in our streams. We've already lost the fish populations in about 100 miles of stream, including Mammoth Creek, Castle Creek, Blue Springs, Clear Creek, Ipsen Creek, Three Mile, Little Creek, Red Creek, and Parowan Creek. The good news is that those aquatic resources, both the fish and the habitat, can be restored. We're fortunate here in the southern region to have experience with that. Our crew, our aquatics crew here in the southern region, restored 65-plus miles of fish and fish habitat following the Twitchell fire here on the Beaver Mountain. And so we've got people and resources that are experienced and know how to do that. But the sad part is with some of the streams, they will wash out. They'll channelize, they'll downcut. That's just going to happen. There's not much we can do about it, but we do know how to go in after the fact and bring those streams back, and we'll be working on that. It's probably going to be a couple of years before we start on the streams, because we kind of have to let nature take its course first, and then we'll go back in and put effort back into them. In an effort to support the local businesses up around Panguitch Lake that were impacted by just the closures up there and during the season where they make what the majority of their business comes, we have started a tagged fish contest up at Panguitch Lake. It began over the 24th of July weekend and will continue through Labor Day. We put 100 tagged fish in the lake. All of the local businesses have donated prizes so that if anybody catches a tagged fish, they can just take it into one of the local businesses, and they're giving out fishing equipment, sometimes boat rentals and things of that nature. And then in addition to that, on Labor Day weekend, we'll have a drawing for everybody that has captured a tagged fish. Sportsman Fish and Wildlife was generous enough to donate a rifle that we will hold a drawing for on Labor Day to kind of close out that tagged fish contest. We appreciate the partnership that we have there. And that's all I have, unless there's additional questions about the fire or about other things going on in the region. Gene?
First question, a report was public that what tagged game you had in that area had all survived.
Yeah, we did. We have a few radio collared animals in the area of the fire. We didn't lose any of our radio collared animals. The timing of the fire was probably unfortunate, but in some ways fortunate. The 17th of July is when the fire started. That's right within a week of our peak of when our fawning and calving takes place, and so we assume we probably lost at least some of the fawns and calves that were newly born. We don't think we lost many adults. That's a sad thing to have happen, but the reality of it is we probably need fewer mouths on that mountain for the next year or so anyway. And so to have a somewhat reduced reproductive effort this year may not be a bad thing as that mountain recovers from the impacts of the fire.
Yeah. The other question, have you noticed that any game has been moving off from that unit into other units?
I'm not aware of any of our collared animals. Where's Josh at? I saw him come in. Any, you can just give me a yes or no, or if you want, have none that we're aware of that have moved off the unit. But the number of collared animals we have is relatively low, but we haven't seen any of them leave the unit, Gene. You're welcome. Any other questions? All right, thank you.
Okay, we'll move to our next action item, which is item number 6. That's the Hunter Education Rule Amendments by Gary Cook.
Oh, there we go. How you doing? I'm glad to be here tonight. Get this up and going here. I've got a few proposed amendments for you to the Hunter Education Rule. This last legislative session, we had a bill passed through the session, House Bill 67. couple of things that this bill did. Number one, it clarified the existing education requirement. There was a little bit of change in some of the language there. But that basically states that prohibits an individual from acquiring or possessing a hunting license or permit or a fur harvester license without successfully completing an approved education course. The other thing that the bill did, is really the focus of the bill, was to allow the Wildlife Board the flexibility to establish criteria and standards of what an approved education course is and consists of. It also establishes the procedures for verifying that an individual has successfully completed an approved education course. So the problem that we had seen and had been dealing with, previously, individuals were allowed to enter their own hunter education numbers into the system. This led to some errors or even the possibility of being able to defraud the system. An individual may have thought they remembered their number, transposed a number, put down a license number rather than an education number, or thought, gee, I'm not sure what it is, entered 123456, and the system said, yep, that's within the parameters and would accept it. So we had a lot of problems with people being able to enter their own numbers. So the proposed amendments, as I said, the procedures for verifying course completion, what this basically says is at the time of application, when an individual goes to purchase a license or apply for a permit, they have three options. Number one, they already have a valid hunter education number in our division customer database. If you're in there, you're good to go. If you're not in that database, then the second option is to provide the division with a certificate of completion, a blue card from Utah, another state's certificate of completion of a hunter education or fur harvester education course. The third option at that time is to certify by a sworn statement, a self-certification option for individuals that don't have that that proof, if you will, for completing a course with them at that moment. They're able to go in and fill out that sworn statement that they have completed a course, just don't have the number. If that's the option that the individual chooses, then we can go back and research that individual's education records to verify that they have, in fact, completed an approved course. Any person that can't be verified then obviously has to be able to complete an approved course before they can obtain that license or permit. Additional amendments to the rule, we have quite a few changes in there to the definition of terms. That includes the criteria and the standards for that approved education course, aligns with current procedures, updated program procedures, and addresses the addition of fur harvester education program requirements. Previously, the fur harvester education requirements were not in the administrative rule. It was only found in state statute. The bill that went through specifically asked us to put those program requirements in the administrative rule. We'd previously just relied on the state statute and really treated it much like we do the hunter education program. There are a few slight differences, and those are spelled out now in the administrative rule. So the results of these proposed amendments will help us find some balance there between helping us ensure hunter safety while out in the field, but still providing that customer service to the hunters at the time that they're applying or purchasing a permit or license. This new process will successfully address those problems with entering numbers that I talked about before. Important to note, really the public will not see hardly any differences to how they obtain a license or permit. This is basically the process that they're asked to go through now. We're just updating our rule and making sure that we have everything up to date and in compliance. Also, important to note, the trial hunting program. That remains an exception to the hunter education rule. It doesn't change any of this. These amendments don't change anything with that trial hunting program. And that is still a fairly easy route to introduce new hunters to the sport under a qualified mentor. And that's basically the presentation that I have, unless there are any questions.
Questions from the rack? Gene?
On this certification, what I'm wondering about is I put in the applications for all my family or they don't get in. And all I do is check the box that says they have hunter education.
Self-certify. Mm-hmm.
Is that all that's going to have to happen?
Well, at some point, if you're in that self-certification loop, then we will ask you to, you know, provide that proof that they've completed a hunter education course and get into the division database with a number. And if that can't be provided, if at that time you can't provide that proof, they would have to take a course. But and the last couple of years that we've been, you know, kind of in this situation, you've been able to go back and continue to do that self-certification. With these changes to the administrative rule, that'll give us the option to be able to turn that off at some point. If you've received notification that you've got to provide that proof to the division that they've in fact completed a course, then you wouldn't be able to select that self-certification option.
Okay. And if I do as I often do and don't submit the applications until 48 hours before the deadline.
Again, at the time that you're submitting that application, and the self-certification option will be there, unless you have, and after an application period, we have some time, and that's where we get that list from our licensing department of who is self-certified. We go through and try to clean that up, and then make those contacts if needed to let people know we need to see that proof of certification.
Thank you.
Tammy.
I have a similar question. So my kids, I was very proud to carry my blue card, and I used to know my number, but that was 100 years ago. And now when I apply for it, because I'm too old, I don't even have to put that in because I'm born before the date. Mm-hmm. So I've done the same thing like Gene has with my kids, where we all fill it out, and your automatic information just pops up on the website. And you use your COR number or whatever pops up. Is there no record in the state bank of when we originally put in those blue card numbers? I don't even know if they still call them blue cards. We used to call them blue cards.
We do still call them blue cards. The process has changed a little bit over the years. Now, when a new student takes the hunter education course, it's automatically linked to their customer profile. So that information is just, as soon as they get that blue card, that's in the database. So they'd fall in under that first option there of already being in the database. We do have, and you know, for years have constantly tried to update and improve our historical records. It gets better all the time, but we do still have some problems with that database from years past and from the you know, the procedures that were followed before we had everything automated. And that's where it comes into there, where if we can't find it, either in our hard copy records or in that division database, if the customer can't provide a blue card, a wall certificate, some sort of proof that they have completed that course, then that's, again, why we have the language there that if you can't provide that proof, we don't have it in our database, they'd have to take a course again.
Okay.
Riley, it sounds like you're going to have to give a hunter safety course to the children of the RAC members.
Yes.
Anybody else? Do we have questions from the audience? It looks like we only have one microphone. If you do come up for questions or comments, we'll have to share this microphone. And please state your name when you come up as well so we can have that on the record. Okay, don't see any questions, or do we have any comments from the audience? Any cards?
Not on six. No.
Okay, any comments from the rack? Gene?
It's not a comment, I just thought of another question, and that is, how much of a problem is this? How often does it come up?
We see a pretty good-sized list. It's getting better each time we go through and you know, clean up this this database, this list of self-certification a little bit more. But with a big game draw, when you have 400,000-plus applicants, my staff is probably getting a list of 3,000 or 4,000 names after a big game draw that we've got to go through and take the time to clean up or request proof of certification from people. Again, as we do this and go through this process, every time it gets a little bit better and those numbers go down.
Less than 1%.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. All right, I'm ready to entertain a motion.
Make a motion. We accept the proposal as presented.
Okay, do we have a second?
Second.
Okay. I have a second from Rusty. Any discussion? All those in favor? Looks unanimous. Thank you. We'll move on to the next item, which is item number 7. And this is the fur bearer rule amendments, and that'll be Darren presenting for us.
All right, let me get situated here. I'm like 8 feet tall. So. I will be doing the next 4 items. So my strategy has been to try to get through these as quickly as possible, provide as much of the information as I can. And of course, if you have questions, we can get deeper into these issues. The first item I wanted to make a recommendation on is our fur bearer and trapping rule, R657-11. The reason that we're asking for some changes to this, we actually just did this last year, but one of the things we changed last year is we made our fur bearer rule pertain only to protected wildlife species. Immediately we had some concerns, both from the Trappers Association and from our law enforcement section, about non-protected wildlife and what people had to do in order to trap coyotes, for example, and be out in the field. The Trappers Association was concerned that it left kind of a gray area there on checks and things like that. They wanted to have something a little bit more firm, so they knew they were complying with the rules. They wanted to make sure that people were out there doing trapping ethically. They didn't want people setting on baits and things like that because they were trying to trap other things. And from our law enforcement perspective, we did have some people that were out claiming to be trapping coyotes, but were probably trying to target other animals. And if you're not trapping a protected species, you don't have to mark your trap. You don't have to check the traps, you know, the 48-hour, 96-hour traps. So we put a committee together and delved into this. The first question that arose is, what is the division's authority to regulate trapping of non-protected species? The Division of Wildlife Resources doesn't have management authority over coyotes and raccoons and other non-protected species. So we looked at the data. There's a report that's going to be coming up out of the Association of Fish and Wildlife Agencies, which is sort of the North American group that represents wildlife agencies across the United States and in Canada and I think in Mexico as well. And that's where they have a committee that looks at trapping specifically, where a lot of the best practices manuals come out of OFWA. And their newest data shows that there is a significant risk whenever you put a trap out there that you may catch something that you didn't intend to catch. And so we felt like because protected wildlife were vulnerable, that the division then had authority to regulate trapping activities within the state to try to protect those protected species or to manage those protected species. And so here are our recommendations for changes. The first is that any trapping that takes place outside of 100 feet of a home or outbuilding occupied by humans or livestock must comply with the trapping rules established by the Utah Wildlife Board. It specifically lists coyotes and raccoons, so those two unprotected species. So what this means is that if you're setting a trap in the state outside of that envelope around your property, that you need to comply with the trapping rules. The next change we're recommending is that a person, in order to trap outside of that area, a person must possess a valid trap registration license. Currently, you have to have a trap registration number. This is going to be, we're changing it, we're calling it a license. If someone currently has a trapping registration number, we're just going to transfer that over at no cost. So people that are currently in the system will receive a license, and that trap number stays with them. That's not going to change. So if they've got their traps marked already, they're not going to have to scratch them off and put a new number on. And that's a one-time thing. If you aren't currently in the system, you would need to purchase a trapping license for $10, and that's a one-time deal. Just need to do it once. Also, we would like to recommend that a person carry that trap registration license with them when they're in the field so that our officers can check that, make sure they have it. That would include on our app. It'll be downloadable, so you can put it on your phone. And then the last thing is it provides some criminal liability in the rule for people that are complying with the rule but accidentally trap something they didn't intend to. So let me just go through what you would have to do to avoid any kind of criminal liability. First of all, you're not attempting to take an unauthorized species. Secondly, you've got your license. Thirdly, you have all the proper licenses, permits, tags to do what you're doing out there. And then finally, you're complying with the wildlife code. So in other words, if you're following the trapping rule, the new rule would provide some immunity from criminal prosecution if you catch a bobcat while you're trying to catch coyotes, or you catch a mountain lion in a bobcat set or something like that. And that's it.
Questions from the rack? Braden? Yeah, I have a question regarding trapping coyotes. You mentioned that the authority does not rest with DWR, right, on managing coyotes or, right, raccoons, but yet you're asserting authority by establishing trapping regulations on them.
Right.
Do I understand that?
Right. And the reason we are is because there's a risk that you could catch something you didn't intend to catch.
Right. And I understand. Okay. I understand the risk. How is this going to impact those that are hired by the livestock industry to keep coyotes out of sheep?
We've got a memorandum of understanding with Wildlife Services, and it won't change anything for those guys. They'll still be able to.
How about if a rancher wants to hire a pretty good trapper in the area to come and trap while he's having trouble?
You'd need to have that trap number on his traps.
But then they are, I guess, subject to the 48 trap. And that's another concern over coyote trapping, because any trapper knows you can't catch a coyote if you're checking your, can't right. catch a lot of coyotes if you're checking your equipment every 48 hours.
Right. It's 48 hours for a live set, a leg hold, and it's 96 hours for a lethal, like a snare, that's intended to kill the animal.
And I guess that's where my concern is, yeah, is narrowing that down to where you're taking the efficiency away from the trapper of stopping depredation on livestock.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So my question, Braden, and then we'll come back to Craig.
My question probably builds on what he was saying. I'm not a trapper, but I am good friends with one of the, I think he's the vice president of the Trappers Association. And they were, my understanding is they were quite excited about this idea that now we could finally trap coyotes efficiently. That's not what I heard you say. I heard you say...
I sat down with the president, vice president, secretary, and they brought this up. They didn't like it being a gray area like this. They wanted us to make some changes, but, and they support this.
They do changes. Support
yes.
this. Okay, and I was hoping that someone would be here to speak for them. Maybe there will be in a second. But I guess the question, not only livestock, but it also affects, you know, we've invested a lot of money into the Mule Deer Protection Act and different mm-hmm. things. I'm just wondering, what options were explored to allow a longer check time? When you sat down and reviewed this, what options did you explore, and was there really no way we could do that?
We didn't talk about check times. A concern that the trappers brought up to me was that they were concerned about longer check times. They're getting a lot of pressure from outside groups about trapping ethics. And now best practices is 96 for lethal and 48 for leg hold. So there was no discussion with them, and therefore we didn't discuss it as a group trying to extend check times.
Mm-hmm. Craig? Mine kind of ties in with what you kind of partially answered it. I was concerned about the snares
right.
and what their situation was with them, because actually on our farm, my son killed a coyote the other day that was been caught in the snare and still had broke the snare loose, and it wouldn't have lived too long, but he found it that way anyway.
Yeah.
Anybody else? Riley?
Yeah, this may sound a little bit minute, considered some of the other stuff that's been questioned, but I know a lot of old-time trappers that are probably going to struggle a little bit carrying something around with them that they've never been asked to carry. Mm-hmm. The question is how lenient is law enforcement going to be, and what are the repercussions if you've got a 70-year-old trapper such as my old man that's out there who has never been asked other... I mean, he's going to have... I'm going to have to explain this to him.
Right.
So there's a lot of these folks that are like that. What's the process, and what's the enforcement when that happens?
Currently, if you're trapping protected wildlife, you have to have your fur bearer license on you.
So, correct.
So this is just an additional thing that you'd have to have on your person. Now, if you're trapping unprotected, this would be something new. You'd have to have with you. Law enforcement, you know, they have a little bit of discretion, and I think they'll, you know, they deal with things on a case-by-case basis. This change would require that license to be carried, just like a fishing license or a hunting license or anything like that.
I understand the process behind it, and I would certainly hope that law enforcement would take that in consideration, especially the first little while this is ongoing
right.
with these gentlemen, especially some of our older generation that taught us how to do these things, because it's going to be an adjustment. I know it sounds like a little thing, but some of those little things are what they hold on
right.
to.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Gene?
I go a long ways back.
Yeah, really.
I know I look young, but I'm not. Everybody had a few traps at one time.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody had a license. Nobody had to tag their traps or anything. Now, maybe we've outgrown that and got completely past it. But this 100-foot rule and on private property, it sounds to me like somebody that might revert back to the old days that I once yeah. lived and may have some free roaming animals that mm-hmm. wander more than 100 foot away from his building.
Right. there's no nothing magic about that 100-foot line. That's just a number that we chose. It seemed reasonable. So if, you know, if the RAC wants to discuss different distances, I'm sure that we can work with that. The intent, though, is that we don't want to regulate stuff going on in and around people's properties. A trap would include a mouse trap. It would include just about anything, and we don't want to be in the business of regulating that. So the intent is, if people are trapping in the field where they're likely to catch a protected species, we want to make sure that people are following the trapping rule.
Well, that's the intent, but right. If you make a regulation of 100 feet, then people could be in non-compliance.
And we don't want to put people in that situation. So, yeah.
Just on that, just to be clear, that the 100-foot was, it looked like it was in a family dwelling.
Right.
That's not
dwelling,
necessarily
outbuildings,
property line.
Any it's structures.
Yeah. So it's, but it is structures. Yeah. So I mean, right. If you've got 200 or 300 acres that of private property, you're gonna have to follow those same rules on your own private property.
Right. Yeah. Similar okay. to you know, you need a deer license to shoot deer in your
no, but I'm
fields.
but I'm saying now with the hundred feet, it's going to apply to all of that where before it didn't necessarily have to with the coyotes and
right.
raccoons.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah, the 100 feet you don't have to comply.
No, what I'm asking is, so the whole property now, though, you're talking...
You've always had to comply with the whole property. They're giving you 100 feet now that you don't have to comply with.
In the past, if you're trapping protected wildlife on your private property, you've always had to comply by the rules.
No, I'm not talking protected. I'm talking non-protected.
Yeah. No. Yeah, and that's always been a bit of a gray area. This was so 3 years ago, before we made this change, you would have had to then. It's only been about a 2-year window that they specifically exempted non-protected wildlife from the rules.
Okay,
that's a new change.
And that was the
and
question.
And now we're going back to that. That's too. It's too much gray. So we're really going back to where we had been in the past.
Okay,
and that's why the Trappers Association were concerned. That we used to be this way. We changed it. People are trying to feel their way in the dark and figure out what exactly they didn't want to get in trouble,
right?
And so they want to make sure that it was clear, and so we tried to clarify.
And to Gene's point, and correct me if I'm wrong, Darren, I think the two RACs that have already seen this, they did discuss that 100 feet
right.
and made a recommendation to make it a larger buffer. I think 600
feet yeah.
came out of both of the previous RACs.
Right. And again, you know, this is people in a room trying to figure out a distance, so
yeah,
there's it's not magic.
I can see the challenge.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay, Tammy.
Okay, my question is the same thing, because we're kind of like the sheep guys. We've got a lot of property that's continuous, but there's no corrals or outbuildings or mm-hmm. anything else, and we're kind of out there in the alone in the boonies, so there's not a whole lot of protected wildlife, but... So I guess it just goes back to what the original...
Yeah, this goes back to what it was 3 years ago, except that we add some language to not try to regulate around, yeah.
Okay.
Wade?
So, Darren, just a question, and this is going to require some speculation, so I'm sorry. But
I'm great at speculating.
My concern is a little bit like Mike's. Yeah, we changed the rule a couple of years ago. It's been wonderful. It really did open up some leeway, some new avenues for the agriculture community. I appreciate the Trappers Association, of which I am a member. I appreciate their opinion and their stance. But I think if we had talked to the Farm Bureau or the Wool Growers Association, we'd have probably got a little different idea as to, let's leave it the way it is right now, because we're kind of loving it. I understand the balancing act, where we're at between everybody likes dead coyotes. We all want to kill coyotes. That's the point. But we also want to protect protected wildlife. And so I understand the balancing act. I guess my question is, This is the speculation part. How many fewer coyotes are we going to kill because of this change back?
I can speculate.
Okay.
I suspect that since this is kind of going back to where we were before, it'd be similar. I don't think we've seen a decrease or an increase over the last couple of years when things have changed. And to be frank, according to the presidency of the Trappers Association, guys have just kind of been continuing on the old way things were because they weren't sure. And really the biggest problem we've had is a law enforcement problem where guys saw this huge loophole to drive through. And, you know, we've got guys on revocation out trapping coyotes. And so, again, that's a relatively small number of people. But it does allow our enforcement guys to make a case if there's something in black and white about what's legal and what's not. So,
thanks.
Can I respond to that for a minute, Darren? Mike made a point that it's hard to trap coyotes if you're going right up to your trap every 48 hours, and that's absolutely right. But a good coyote trapper also knows how to check his traps without going right to them and using binoculars and putting flags on. There's lots of states that are much more stringent than we are, and people have figured out ways to make this work, and they will in Utah as well.
Thanks, Steve. Thanks.
Braden.
Again, I'm not a trapper, so I'm speaking in ignorance here. But I guess then I would have a question on what is the definition of checking the trap? I didn't realize you could check it from 1,000 yards away in a spotting scope. Is there a definition on checking the trap? Because that... you make a good point.
I don't think so. What you need to do is verify whether the trap is empty or not. So whether you can do that from a distance or... Right.
It makes me feel a little better.
Okay. Good.
You're me both.
Right.
Okay. Any more questions, Berlin?
Well, before I came today, yesterday, I met with a trapper there in Wayne County, and he was pretty excited the way it has been, you know, where they don't have to trap check so often. Mm-hmm. It looks to me like the association's just scared of law enforcement. You guys have the... You're kind of in the driver's seat, and you can. That's why they want it in black and white, because there's that gray area, and they know which way it's going to go. So I'd rather leave it the way it is and work on it some other way, because the only good coyote's a dead coyote. That's my thoughts.
Okay. Let's open it up to any questions from the audience. Do we have any questions out there? Please come up to the mic and state your name. Yes, please.
My name is Milt Lobb. I'd just like to know, are we trying to fix a broken problem? Can you give us... numbers on how many cases there were, perhaps people without a license trapping protected wildlife? Is it really an issue, or if we just let it ride the way it is? I mean, it's only been in place for, what, 3 years now? So is that a big enough time to actually take an accurate analysis of how the new program's working, is my other question.
Thank you. And we'll get a response to that.
I don't have an exact number. I know that law enforcement's worked several cases over the last 2 years of people claiming to be trapping coyotes and actually targeting other things. It's difficult to prove that. And since the law currently it has no specific prohibition on that, it makes it difficult for them to prosecute. I mentioned that, you know, we do have people on revocation that are that are participating, which was another law enforcement concern. And I guess I don't know if that's an effective, I don't know if that helps. I can't give you a number. And again, you know, when they're working cases, they're not real forthcoming about numbers, so they're real careful about that kind of thing.
Okay. If we don't have any further questions, we don't have any comment cards. So is there any further comments from the RAC? Wade?
So I guess my comment is just a follow-up to my question. I can appreciate the law enforcement dilemma and gray areas, even though I'm not in law enforcement, but I can appreciate where they're at and that struggle. I can also appreciate that, you know, there's some untargeted take that nobody likes. But if we look at the trade-off, if we can kill more coyotes staying the way we are, and by doing so, save some more fawns, save some more calves, you know, save some more lambs. It's just a balancing act, as I mentioned before, and so I can appreciate both sides of it. But if we've got a few criminals out there and a few more law enforcement guys with a little uneasy feeling versus a lot of dead lambs and fawns, I could justify keeping it the way it was. I just don't want to change for the sake of a few if it's really affecting many. I guess that's my biggest concern, even though I can understand the concerns of a few. So I could leave it the way it was if I was king for a day, probably.
That's good. I'd like to make that.
Okay. Braden?
A couple comments. It was interesting because, like I said, I talked with the, and I guess he's the past vice president of the Trappers Association. So I sent him a text because I thought, this does not jive with the conversation you and I had not too long ago. Let me quote him, and he didn't say any swear words, so I think I can.
which is...
He says, "No, the new officers do, but the rest of the members are pissed." So it doesn't sound like it went over real well. Then, as Wade indicated, you know, it didn't, as far as we know, or you haven't indicated that it didn't go out to the cattlemen and the sheep herders. So there's one comment. The next comment I'd have is, in general, I really like to err on the side of less regulation unless there's a real reason to have more regulation. And my additional comment to that is, criminals will always be criminals. Poachers will always be poachers. Trapping is probably one of the easier ones to cheat at. So what you're... I like to help honest people stay honest. And if that can mean killing more coyotes potentially, that would be the side I would lean on.
Okay. Let me just comment. There is some protection here for someone who accidentally catches something they're not intending to. That is not currently in the rule, so I don't know if you want to consider that or not.
And so I'm sorry, Mike, if you want to go first. You. So the way I understand it now, if you make a decision, a conscious decision to target coyotes, and you go set your stuff out there for a week and a half, you're a big boy, we're all adults here, and you catch a bobcat, that's on you. You can get ticketed, that's on you, because you didn't check your traps every 48 or 96 or whatever it is. I'm all about accountability. I mean, if you make the big boy decision and you're an adult and you say, you know what, I'm trapping coyotes and I accidentally catch a bobcat, I can get in trouble for that. I think I'm all about personal accountability. And I think that sometimes we baby stuff along and we take it away. That's just thoughts I'm having. If that's the way I understand that rule.
Right.
Okay.
Mike's got a comment.
Go ahead, Mike.
Okay.
I appreciate all the input we've got, but I don't feel that's all the input that we need. I was kind of disappointed that none of the wool growers, nor the cattlemen, nor the Farm Bureau had been discussed when this impacts their operations and the impact that it'll have on the on their number of livestock and whatever else. And I could not go along with this the way it is without their input, and therefore I would like to see us have a motion that continues as is until we get that input and make it a broader issue or a broader input.
I'm not quite ready to accept the motion yet. I think there's still a few more comments out there, but Riley, did you have a comment?
Yeah. It makes me just a little bit uneasy. I would have to go along with some of the other comments from the other RAC members as far as it definitely appears to be more of an issue of regulating on the law enforcement side on a check time that is currently, I mean, that's law, and that's, I understand that, and that's fine. And it doesn't appear to have a lot of data one way or the other that says that it's going to help, it's going to hurt. It really, it's only clearing up an issue, and that concerns me that it's similar to, I believe it was Braden that said it's more of a, it's definitely more of a regulation step rather than allowing these guys to do what they can do and help out the wildlife. I'm kind of the same way. I think I'd lean on the side of leaving it the way it is, and let's gather some data and some other info from some of these other groups and parties, and I'd love to hear some of that info and that data before I could go on with it.
Okay. Brian?
One thing that I've noticed as I've sat up here for a handful of years is we get these law enforcement, and I can accept and I agree that there are challenges with law enforcement, absolutely. We get these rules to help with law enforcement, and I've asked, well, how many problems are there? And we never know. We never know. Maybe we just have one law enforcement officer that's really squealing. But
the Trappers Association. That's
okay.
Proposal came from the Trappers Association.
Did it?
Yes.
Okay, and I get that too, and so I apologize, but this has happened in the past where we ask, where we say, hey, how many incidents have we actually had, and no one ever knows because we don't track that type of stuff. And I'm talking particularly with bear hunting, over baits, over dogs chasing them off. There's problems and there's not problems. They're made believe problems. So I guess the real question that I'm bringing up is, when there's a problem like this that's a new rule change, is there any way to document how many problems there are so we can actually make an informed decision? I mean, we document everything else. I'm just wondering if there, I don't know the challenges. I'm sure that there are challenges with it. So just a suggestion of coming to us with actual numbers instead of somebody said. So.
Yeah, Brian, and I don't want to embarrass Darren here, but I suspect that data exists. Our law enforcement guys track everything.
And I believe they do. We just never see it.
Yeah.
I'm sure they do.
I'll talk to the mic.
And I'm sure they do. We just never see it.
And I
apologize. Maybe this isn't the place to bring it up.
Where's Mike at? Come give us your 2 cents. I still don't see you. There you are.
Wow.
Got these binoculars on.
These for this corner. Literally. These for this corner.
So specifically, Micah, talk about the data, how the data is tracked, and then have you personally, in your area, seen where this has made it enforcement more difficult?
It hasn't made enforcement
more difficult. Come to the mic.
It hasn't just made in law enforcement difficult. It's made it almost impossible. I know of 5 cases where we had suspects killing protected wildlife using trapping methods illegally. When we went and talked to him, his excuse was, I'm just trapping coyotes. The way the rule is right now, there's nothing we could do to him. Okay? It happens all the time.
Didn't we just ask that question? If right now, if you put your big boy pants on and you say, I'm trapping coyotes, and you take something else illegally, then you're accountable for that take.
No, and I was going to comment on that, Brian. That's the loophole that this has created. If you do that and you claim, no, I was just trapping coyotes, it's very difficult to prosecute.
Even if they catch something?
Even if they catch something and they hadn't checked their traps for a week and a half.
And that's why the
issue with the trap numbers, okay, I'm hearing a lot of discussion, oh, this is going to stop guys from killing coyotes. This isn't stopping anybody from killing coyotes. What this is doing is requiring that they say who they are when they're using that device. Because we've had snares put out by guys trying to catch coyotes that have killed deer. They've killed dogs. They've killed bobcats. They've killed things other than the item they're trying to catch. And when we get called as law enforcement, we show up and we investigate that. We have no idea whose trap it is, which is what the trap number would tell us. Hey, this is so-and-so's trap. All right, we can now go talk to him, find out if he's participating in the activity legally. Okay, we can then track down whose trap it is. Does he have all the required pieces on it? This change is not going to affect what our trappers are doing other than require that they say who they are when they're doing it in the field.
And check.
And we have heard people, and check, okay? I've seen snares, I've seen traps take eagles, I've seen them take all kinds of non-target protected wildlife, and they don't have a trap number on them, and they say, oh, I'm trapping coyotes. If they had the trap numbers, at least I'd know who was participating in the activity.
Okay, thank you, Michael.
Sure. Wade.
So, I actually appreciate what Michael brought up because a lot of my comments, and I think a lot of the other board members, strictly revolved around the check. I think the other stuff makes a lot of sense. And I appreciate Darren and all the work they've done. To me, this is a good, measured, common sense solution to the problem. My holdup is if we even tie one hand behind somebody's back that allows them to not catch as many coyotes. I don't care. I would vote against tying one finger back if they are going to catch more coyotes. And that's my only concern. I think that the points Micah brought up make a whole lot of sense. And I think this is a good measured approach. I just like dead coyotes.
Okay. Let's try to wrap it up, but let's go down to Mike.
Yeah, I can appreciate what Mike said. I'm not hung up on the changing of the requirement to tag traps and snares or whatever. I think that's a good idea. It holds people accountable for their own equipment, and if they're there. Where I am is kind of have a problem is the 48-hour trap check. It's either going to impact how many animals you're going to take to protect livestock, or it's going to make thieves out of, or non-compliant people out of everybody, because I can guarantee you, you go to 48-hour, there's not going to be many trappers that are going to adhere to that, and there's not enough law enforcement out there to verify that yes, they're checking their traps 48 hours or whatever else. So,
with the 48-hour checks, it depends right on what they're using. I'm a trapper. Okay, I trap. I don't go anywhere near my traps for weeks because I can look at them from 200, 300 yards away through a spotting scope or a set of binoculars, and I know what's there. 48 hours, all that, the people who, in my experience as a law enforcement officer, the people who the 48-hour law puts in a jam are the people who are not doing it legally in the first place.
Okay, if you go out and find a trap, and you monitor that trap for, say, 2 weeks,
okay,
and you don't see any tracks there.
Okay.
And then he catches something and goes and gets it, or are you going to write him up?
I would have.
Because what you're saying is you're not coming close. You're just up on a hill, and anybody could say, I've been up on a hill.
Sir, I would have to prove that he was not checking that trap within that 48-hour time period. And there are ways for us to do that. But in my experience, most people are walking in their traps every 96 hours, even if they're looking at them, or what they're doing is they're checking every 48 hours. The only people who we see who don't check every 48 or don't check on a kill trap in 96 are the guys who are trying to get away with breaking the law.
Exactly.
So the 48 hours and the 96-hour rules, they really don't harm honest trappers. Who they harm are the guys they put in the jam or the guys who are willingly going out to try to break the law.
And I question that because I've been trapping all my life and even ran programs of trapping.
Yep.
And I know the issues and what's out there, and there's not all the time. If you're trapping out on a flat desert, there's no way you can check that trap without driving by it or walking by it or whatever else. So you can't check it. We've even gone to the extreme of putting radio collar or radio devices on the trap where they close, it sets off a signal to keep the employees in sync with what the requirements were.
Yep.
And so it's a tough situation. And that's my biggest problem is doing something that really I really don't think needs to be done as far as a 48-hour trap check. That's every 2 days. And anybody that's got a job can't get away every 2 days and go check their traps.
It's
impossible.
It yes.
And I'll bet 90% of the Trappers Association people have jobs.
Yeah.
And so I'm saying let's not box people in the corner. Let's give them a little flexibility. And also get the people, this is a, coyote is a UDA, a Utah Division of Agriculture animal, managed animal, but yet the DWR sees fit to go in and make management out of it by the trap checks, and I totally disagree with that. It should be a UDWR or UDA requirement and input from the livestock industry and the trappers and the hunters and whoever else. That's all.
Thank you. I think we've flushed out some pretty good conversation. Does anybody else have anything that they're dying to say? If not, let me just summarize a little bit. It looks like we've seen some options. One is to accept the changes as presented. Another one that Kevin mentioned was some of the other acts have increased the distance from 100 feet to 600 feet. Or, and we've also talked in length about leaving the rule the way it is now. So there's something to consider, and I'll entertain a motion. You got another option? Let's throw out one more option if you go.
Mr. Chairman, if you could.
Hold on just a second. Wade's got one more option.
Wade, go ahead. I'm just going to throw it out there. I love a lot of this stuff and would really support it all if we maybe entertained, if we're lengthening the distance from a structure, could we not lengthen trap check? I know that's a big old can of worms, but I'm throwing it out there. Change it all to 96. Let me say that in my case. I'd say change it all to 96.
Okay, let's start with the motion. Mike, did you have a motion?
I would like to move that we table this conversation until we've had more input from UDA and the livestock industry and hunters and trappers and whoever else.
Can I second that?
Okay. Before we take a second, let me just explain that we can vote to table that, but the board would have to vote to table that for it to come back to us. And so,
but the recommendation that we would make on this motion would be for the board to table it.
So, Mike, I would suggest that you just make a motion not to accept the recommendation and keep it the way it is right now.
Okay, then let me change my motion to not to accept the recommendation as proposed.
Okay, do we have a second?
What if, just before
we
second?
We have a second. We can't discuss it until we see if we got a second.
Yeah, Tammy.
Second. Tammy has a second. Now we're open for discussion. Brian?
I think that it might send a better message if we made a motion to accept it as presented and we all voted against it.
I don't know what that does. That's not going
to. So let's. I mean, we're going to have to. We're going to either have to amend this. Now, what did we? What was the motion? I guess. To not accept it? To keep it the way it is.
I think
there's some good stuff in there. I think it's good if there's a coyote hunter out there to put a tag on his trap. I think that's a good thing, guys. I mean, if you're going to say you're a coyote hunter and you're not going to check your traps, you need to be accountable for that. I don't know if it's all bad here. I think that there might be a better way. I don't know. I'm open. Let's obviously discuss it.
I think we need to send something to the board that is a clear opinion from us.
Absolutely.
Okay. Help me understand processes a little bit here. We've got a motion. We've got a second. So we have to vote on that.
Well, you can make a motion to amend it, and then you vote on the amendment.
Okay.
If the amendment passes, then you've amended the motion. If the amendment fails, you're back to the original
motion. But the
motion
is to leave it the way it is, and to amend it, I'd say I like some of this stuff. It seems like it's getting really convoluted if you make an amendment to this motion. Mm-hmm. So if this motion doesn't pass, do we make a new motion, or does it go forward?
No, you make it. Okay. We can vote on it,
and if we don't vote for it, then we'll make another motion.
Right. There has to be something that passes from this rack before we're going to move forward.
Because my thought is kind of what was just said, is I think there's a lot of really good parts of this. I just don't like the trap check part.
Mr. Chairman. So, Mike, I like the principle behind where we're headed with this motion, but I don't know that it's got the legs without making some changes to it. I think it's gonna get shot down if we don't make some changes. So we either amend it or we just vote and then start over.
Right. Vote against it if that passes.
We're not necessarily voting.
Well, we're going to vote the way the motion is presented at this time. And that motion right now is not to accept the plan as presented. And we have a second. And so now we have an opportunity to vote. All those in favor, and hold your hands up high so we can count them. Vote.
This is to not accept.
The vote is to not accept the plan.
To not change the trapping regulations, to keep them the way they are right now.
Yes. Okay. We have a count. All those opposed? We have a count. So it fails 4-6. Okay. I will entertain a new motion. Wade.
I'm dumb enough to try. Mr. Chairman, I move that we accept the division's recommendations with the following changes. One being that the footage from a structure is changed from 100 feet to 600 feet. And the second change being that trap check requirements are extended to 96 hours for both. Whatever you call.
Okay. Do we have a second? Okay, we have a second from Rusty. So we have a motion and a second to accept the recommended changes with the exception of increasing the distance from a building to 600 feet and make all trap check times to 96 hours. Regardless of the type of trap. So we'll open that up to discussion.
Would that give law enforcement some teeth if somebody decides that they're hunting coyotes, and that would give them the teeth that we want, right?
Yes. Okay. All those in favor? Hold your hands. All right. Is that everybody? Any opposed? One opposed. Okay. Motion carries. Let's move on to the next item. And that is item number 8, which is the fur bearer and bobcat harvest recommendations for 2017 and 18.
All right, now that we've taken care of that, let's move on to recommendations for harvest for protected species. So these are our recommendations for bobcat and fur bearer harvest in the next year. Just a quick reminder, this is how we manage bobcat take. In the state, we have three management criteria. The first one is that the number of juveniles in the harvest should be between 42 and 56%. If it's higher than 56%, that's okay from a biological standpoint. If it's lower, then we want to make changes to either our season length or the number of tags that are available out there. So having said that, here are the data over the last, since 2000, over the last 17 years on percent juveniles in the take. Red line there represents the lower end of that window, that 42%. You can see over the last 3 years we've been above the target. And so we are in a good range there management-wise. The second criteria is adult survival. We want to see that adult survival between 65 and 72%. Again, higher is okay. Lower, we'd want to look at changes to limit take. Here's the data on that. This is a survival estimate with a confidence interval. So the blue broken lines are, you know, when you see a pole and it says plus or minus, that's kind of what we're looking at. The red dotted line is the target threshold, and something with Excel, it makes that last point look like it's below the line. It's actually on the line. So we are within the window, but we're on the lower end. And then you can see the data there since 2000. Third criteria, percent females in the harvest. We want that to be between 41 and 45%. If it's lower than that, it means we're taking fewer females and production should be maintained. If it's higher than that, we want to make changes to management to try to limit the number of females taken. And there's the data. This is, again, one of these days I'm going to get tech savvy and figure out why it did this, but that last point should be right at that lower line. And so we are within the window, but we're on the lower end. Again, for females, that's good. You want to have fewer females in your harvest. So here's the last 3 years of data, if you want to look at trends and the management target. All of the management parameters are within the target range for bobcats. Another question that came up last year that I thought I'd touch on is 3 years ago, we changed the regulations for bobcat permits to allow no cap, and each person could have up to 6 permits. I'm sure you all remember that. You can see when that change took place, sales shot way up and participation shot way up. It also equally quickly came down. I think people got excited, went out, bought their tags that first year, and then kind of figured it wasn't quite what they thought it was. And so things are kind of coming back to pre-change levels. Although in the past you can see that those numbers fluctuate. The thing that seems to make those numbers fluctuate the most are the price of pelts, which I'm sure you can relate to. So it tends to be kind of a predator-prey type of thing. Pelt prices go up, tag sales go up, pelt prices go down, tag sales and participation goes down, and they kind of cycle and follow each other through time. So, our recommendations for next year are no changes to the current management strategy. So, 6 tags per individual with no cap, and the dates would be November 15th through March 1st, 2018. In addition, these are our recommended dates for other fur-bearing species. So beaver and mink would be September 23rd through April 4th. And then marten, badger, gray fox, kit fox, ringtail, spotted skunk, and weasel would be the 23rd of September through March 1st. And that's all I have.
Thank you. We have questions from the rack. Wade.
Darren, why did the adult survival rate drop these last 2 years?
You saw the big kick up. I think you know, a lot of people went afield, and they were successful to some degree. So we did see an increase in harvest, and you'd expect to see more adults taken in those years. Trend-wise, we'll just have to keep an eye on that.
Gene.
Do you make these recommendations on a single year or a three-year average? Or?
We look at trends, but each year we look at where we are in relation to the targets and make recommendations for permits that year. So we can adjust yearly if we need to.
Well, looking at the chart, looking at the trend's down.
Right. For that parameter it is, yeah. You have two that are trending in the right direction and one that's going in a concerning direction. The way the plan's written, we'd make adjustments depending on how many of those are out of whack, and we'll either adjust season dates by shortening the season or adjust the number of tags a person can get.
Okay. Do I have any questions from the audience? I don't see any comment cards. Oh, excuse me.
SFW, they don't want to comment, but said that they support the recommendation.
Okay. Did you get that? So SFW, they support the recommendations, but they didn't want to come up. Any comments from the RAC? I'll entertain a motion then. Braden?
I'll make a motion to accept as presented.
Okay, do we have a second? Okay. Riley? Any comments? All those in favor? Any opposed? Okay, that was unanimous. Okay, let's move on to the next action item, which is item number 9, the Cougar Recommendation and Rule Amendments.
All right. Recommendations for our cougar seasons coming up. I'll do the same thing I did with bobcats, just quickly to remind everybody. These are the parameters that we manage to with lion hunting. First of all, how we hunt lions. This is a little bit more involved. First of all, we have three different kinds of take seasons. We have a limited entry season where, just like for big game, there's a certain number of tags. If you draw a permit, you can hunt that unit. Then there's a hybrid where you have a split unit. It starts as limited entry. If there are any permits unfilled at the end of that season, then it turns into a harvest objective unit and will remain open until all of the tags or all the you know, if there's 10 permits and you harvest 8 limit entry, there'd be 2 remaining. Once those 2 animals are taken, the unit would close. And the third is a harvest objective unit, which is open for a quota, essentially. So if you'd have 10 lions, for example, that you wanted to take off of the unit would remain open until those animals are taken. And then the unit would close. The parameters that we manage to for mountain lions, the first is we want to see less than 40% females in the harvest and between 15 and 20% adults in the harvest. Having said that, the plan does allow us to make adjustments for a couple of reasons. One would be if we have prey species of concern, for example, bighorn sheep, that we're concerned about establishing populations, or mule deer that are below objective, chronically below objective, we can go beyond these parameters to try to really force lion numbers down. The other adjustment we would do would be, for example, where we have some chronic livestock problems. We'd want to be able to have the tools to go in and address those problems. So this is our historical harvest. The green line on the top is total animals taken. The blue line is males in the harvest, and the pink line are females in the harvest. You can see back in the mid-90s, we really got after lions pretty heavily. As a result of that, in large part, one of the first cougar plans we wrote was in 1999. The objectives we have now are largely the same as were set forth in that plan. You can see that that kind of leveled harvest off over time. Over the last little while, you'll see that harvest is increasing. And if you look at the blue line there, most of the harvest increase is among males in the population. Female harvest has remained fairly static over the last probably 10 years, it looks like, statewide. One of our parameters were the percent of females in the harvest. As I mentioned, we want that to be below 40%. The blue field are males, percentage of males. The orange or pink or whatever color that is, salmon is below. You can see the dotted line is the objective. So since about 2008, we've been in compliance with that objective statewide. This is the second parameter, percent 5-year-olds and older in the harvest. This is just the trend over time. You can see it jumps around, but you can see it's trending up over the last few years. This graph depicts the average age of harvest, so it includes those older animals, and then this is everything. This is the average age of everything harvested in the state. This is males, and you can kind of see the trend on that data there. It's trending up over time. And this is the female graph. I don't know that I'd hang my hat on that trend line. It's probably, could easily be argued, it's flat. You can throw a trend line on anything in Excel, but it looks kind of flat to me. The next graph shows livestock depredation trends since 2001. What's particularly concerning to us are the last 3 years. We're seeing an increase. The green line are the number of incidences, so the number of times someone calls us or Wildlife Services and says, hey, I've got a lying taken livestock. The orange are the number of animals removed as a result of those reported incidences. Next, I'm going to go through each region's recommendations. I think what I'll do is just highlight the changes. You can see green arrows. Those will indicate increases. Everything else remained the same, and I don't believe we have any reductions this year. So northern region, Box Elder Raft River, we're recommending an increase of 2 permits. The cache, we're recommending an increase of 3. I guess maybe I should explain this table a little bit better. Sorry. First of all, if it says considered for predator management, I spoke earlier about prey species of concern. If there is a prey species of concern on that unit, it'll be listed there. So for these, there aren't. The third column there is the number of permits last year. The fourth column are the permits we're recommending this year. And then the harvest strategy is there on the right. So split harvest objective or limited entry will be over there. And there's a couple others I'll point out as we get there. So moving on, Chalk Creek Camas, we're recommending an increase of 2. Morgan South Ridge, an increase of 4. Northeastern region, no changes to those units. On the South Slope Vernal Bonanza Diamond Mountain, we're recommending an increase of 2 permits. Wasatch Mountains Current Creek North, 2. You're seeing some bighorn sheep show up. On the Central Mountains Nevo Phase, this is Central Region, an increase of 2. Central Mountains Southwest Manti, an increase of 2. An increase of 1 on Oker Stansberry. This first hunt here, still in the central region, is a new hunt we're recommending. I'll show you a map here next, but what they're proposing is there's an area east of Salt Lake in the county that doesn't allow firearms. They'd like to see some lion harvest in that area. That's where a lot of lions that they get into Salt Lake City are coming from. The only option really we have is to maybe offer an archery-only opportunity, so they are recommending that harvest objective. They'd like to see six taken. We'll see how that works out. It's going to be tough, but that would be a new hunt. And then West Desert Tintic Vernon, an addition of three. This is the map of that hunt unit we're talking about. So Salt Lake is on that upper left-hand corner. Riverton and Draper, Point of the Mountain, is on that lower left-hand, did I say right-hand before? Left-hand side. Then it runs up the county line up to Park City and around. But it's Mill Creek, Big Cottonwood Canyons, and that country up there. Moving on to the southern region recommendations. Beaver unit increase of one. The Fillmore Pavon increase of three. One additional tag on Mount Dutton. Two additional tags on Pine Valley North and one additional on Pine Valley South. Southwest Desert, an increase of two, and Zion, an increase of two. One other change here to point out is Plateau Thousand Lakes used to be a split unit. We're recommending we change that to a harvest objective unit. Moving on to the southeastern region. Southeastern has a few, and I think you do too, right, Teresa, that are unlimited units. These are typically, we've got concern about prey species. The remote units, they see very little use. And so we're lucky to get a lion taken a year on those units. So it's open year-round. There's no cap. If you get out there and you can hunt a lion, you can take a lion. We won't ever close those units. South Central Mountain Southeast Manti, an increase of four. 9 Mile North, increase of three. Another couple of unlimited units there. Those aren't changes, but just to kind of give you a bird's eye view of how permits have been allocated since 2015 between harvest objective units and split or limited entry units. We're trending towards more harvest objective type units and less limited entry, just informationally. These are our recommended season dates. Limited entry season would be November 8th through May 31st. Split season would be limited entry from November 8th through the 25th of February, and then it would open as harvest objective from March 1st through May 31st. Harvest objective units would be November 8th of this year through November 3rd of next year. There's a few days of a window there. Unlimited units are year-round, literally year-round. They don't ever close. And then pursuit season would be November 8th through May 31st. And that's all I have.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the rack? Go ahead, Gene, or Craig.
A couple of questions. I see that your depredation's going way up on livestock, I just wondering, does these increases have anything to do with that, or are they?
Some of them are increased because of that. Others are increased because they're within management parameters, and we can increase tags. There's opportunity left, and you know, if you have specific questions about units, I'm sure that the regional folks could tell you.
And now, I guess that was my other question, is on how many of these units are reaching objective, you know, that you're, are they harvesting all the cats that are able to be harvested?
It varies. If you look at your table there, it'll show how many were taken over 3 years compared to. Actually, if you'd like, I can provide you a year-by-year rundown if you've got a question on a specific one. Some are and others aren't. I know that there are a couple of units down here where we don't ever hit. We don't fill all the tags. It seems to be an access issue. People just can't get in there.
Well, yeah, just take the southern region particularly. What units are they killing all the cats and what aren't they?
Teresa, did we close any units this year?
I don't think we did we? Pavant? Say that again. Justin or Jason, come up and tell him what units met the harvest objective this year in the southern region.
If I remember right, we closed both the Pine Valley North and South, and I believe also the Southwest Desert.
And then somebody said Pavant. Did Pavant close?
And Pavant, yes.
Pavant. So we met the harvest objective on those four units.
Yeah.
Beaver and Monroe, I guess. Did you want to double check that, Darren?
Yeah, I'm just trying to filter out by... yeah, right, they know, right? Unfortunately, the northern's on the top. We're talking harvest objective, right? Yeah, I think the ones I heard are the ones that I see here.
Okay, so we've got closure dates here.
Oh, there you go.
Okay, so we've got the Beaver. For just the southern region, we've got the Pavant, the Monroe, Panguitch Lake, Pine Valley North. That's all that my table shows for this year for closures.
Okay. Good.
Okay. Craig.
One follow-up question. Where is most of the deprivation happening? Do you have any idea?
Yeah, that's probably another question for the region.
The two units that we see the most depredation is the Zion unit and Mount Dutton. Anything else significant? Occasionally, a few on the Monroe, but the two major ones are Zion and Dutton.
And those runs are not—they're not able to get all the cats off from.
I believe on Mount Dutton last year, I don't have the annual data in front of me, but we had 14 tags available on Dutton. I believe we killed 8 last year.
Okay. Any other questions? Wade? And then Verlin?
When you make these recommendations, do you take into account the depredation to livestock and adjust the numbers? I know on these columns you talk about deer and bighorn sheep.
But we do. Yeah, particularly, you know, we don't like to see that number increase. We like to provide opportunities for sportsmen to take those animals. You know, on the ground that, you know, with, for example, with the Dutton where you're not filling your tags, you know, you can throw some more tags out there and you may get an additional harvester, you may not. But in addition to that, we work closely with Wildlife Services to make sure that they're able to address problems. They have the tools that they need from us to take care of those problems.
So the take that they'll get on one that's depredating will not be in your count really on this.
It is included on your table,
but not as sport harvest.
Right, but not as sport harvest. So we account for it, but it's in a separate column.
It's not counted against the quota on the
right.
unit.
Yeah.
That's just sport harvest. So if we have a harvest objective of 14 and hunters take 6 and Wildlife Services takes 3, we don't report 9, we only report the 6 against the quota.
All right.
So, Darren, one question. You mentioned that you were highlighting the changes mm-hmm. from last year to this year with the arrows, and I noticed you did that on the permit numbers. Mm-hmm. But I didn't notice that you had highlighted changes on strategies other than just one or two.
That one change on the plateau was the only strategy change.
So I'm hoping very much that there was one other change, or I was hunting illegally. We worked really hard. The Friends of the Poncegont worked really hard to change the Poncegont from split to harvest objective. Was it last year or the year before? And got changed to harvest objective. I had a year-round permit last year for the Poncegont. And you show it as split this year. So I'm thinking that would be a change. Is that?
I can check on that.
On this one, it shows as a harvest objective.
I think just maybe his table's wrong. It is harvest objective and will remain harvest objective.
Okay.
Okay.
I'll make a note of that. Thanks.
That's what we're saying.
But Micah wants to talk to you after the meeting, Wade.
Who does? Micah.
Okay.
Any other questions? Do we have any questions from the audience? Okay. As you come forward, come to this mic and please state your name. And remember, this is the question time, and for comments, we'll entertain those in just a minute.
My name is Dustin Clark. And I have a question as far as the harvest objectives quotas go. The division has a parameter that you want to keep the female quota around 40%. Is that right? So my question is, on those harvest objective units, why can't we set a female sub quota at 40% to shut those units down when 40% of the females are killed?
We used to have female sub-quotas. If you recall, we made changes to the plan, I believe, 2 years ago. To what we were doing is a three-year recommendation cycle with female sub-quotas. Now what we do is look at it annually. It's based on a three years of the previous data, but we look at that annually. And if we drop below that, we'll make changes the following year. So it gives our biologists a little bit of flexibility, and we can also react a little bit quicker.
Then my next question is, on units that we don't fill all the tags, why are they going up?
Some of those are trying to address problems. The Dutton's one, for example, we haven't been filling it. We added an additional tag. That may result in an additional line. It may not. But at least it puts someone else out there with the opportunity, I guess. And that's probably the best way to describe it.
Okay. I do have two comment cards. If we have any other comments, please fill out a card and get those up. The first one is Bryce from SFW. SFW supports the recommendations as presented. And then we'd like to hear from Sharon St. John. If you'd like to come up, go to this mic over here. Maybe you can help her with
here,
the mic
that
as
mic
well.
Down. Right here, sure.
Tell me if that's okay. I just guessed.
Hello. Thank you for the opportunity to comment. I would like to ask you not to make any increases in the hunting quotas for cougars. There are many reasons, but I'll restrict myself to four. One is cougar populations. I know none of you are going to agree with me, but that's okay. I'm going to carry on. And I do appreciate the opportunity to speak. Cougar populations regulate themselves. They're not expanding to be out of control. They don't require human intervention. This was established by a study in 2009 conducted by Oregon State University, and the assumption that cougars have to be hunted in order to be kept under control is just not true, because they limit their own populations. And this study states apex predators are distinguishable by a capacity to limit their own population densities, self-regulation. That's the first point. Second point, it is possible, concerning the depredation on calves and sheep, it is possible, and it's been shown by studies, that hunting cougars may actually cause greater levels of calf and sheep depredation. And I would draw your attention to the fact that the sheep depredation, the calf, I think it is, depredation levels, they've gone up. And this has followed the hunting quotas going up. So it's not just me who thinks there's a correlation. It is possible there is. Concerning the mortality of young calves, only 1 to 2% of these deaths are caused by depredation from all predators, including dogs. All the other calf deaths are caused either by illness or are weather-related. Ranchers are compensated for the loss of their livestock, and non-lethal forms of predator control have been shown to be the most effective response. So there is no reason to kill cougars in order to protect calves. In fact, just the opposite may be true. It has been shown that increased hunting may cause more, not fewer, calf deaths. And so it may be a mistake to do that, to increase the hunting in the hope of lessening livestock population. Because what happens is when the cougars are hunted, that disrupts their natural social order. It means young cougars are separated from their mothers while they're still learning to hunt and learn what their natural prey is supposed to be, which is not supposed to be calves. With fewer adults in the population, hungry adolescent cougars are far more likely to engage in erratic behavior, and we can see that with instances of cougars going near cities and near human structures. That's not their natural behavior. Their natural behavior is to be out in the wilderness as far away as possible. The higher incidence of livestock deaths noted in certain areas could be actually being increased. It could be due to the increase in the hunting of predators in recent years. And if the hunting quotas are increased again, as is planned, then the greater numbers of cougars hunted may lead to even higher livestock deaths in those areas next year and the year after. Okay, point three. This is a study on the cougars in Zion. It was done by Oregon State University, published in 2006. And they looked at Zion National Park. Most of that park, obviously there are a great many visitors, and there are very few cougars. It's only in the North Creek area of Zion where you find the same number of cougars there always were. And the study looked at the effect of the decline of the cougars in the rest of Zion National Park. As the numbers of cougars took a downward dip, herds of mule deer no longer kept moving along as they would naturally do in the presence of cougars. Instead, they spent a lot of time hanging about, congregating in stream beds, browsing on cottonwood and other saplings, and leading a kind of sedentary kind of lifestyle. And the forest was diminished, and the abundance of all wild species, mammals, birds, fish, amphibians, and other plant and animal life went into decline. The stream beds were trampled and muddy, and all life near them dwindled. And this is with the absence of cougars. By contrast, in the North Creek area of Zion National Park, where there was far less human intrusion, both the cougars and the deer remained lively and active, much as they always had, with far less trampling of stream bed erosion and loss of soil. The loss of soil was less than half of what it was in the rest of Zion. There was an abundance of young cottonwood, squirrels, butterflies, lizards, and water plants. There were three times as many fish in the stream. And the wild land stayed healthy and thriving. And all this was because actually cougars are very necessary to nature. We don't actually need to have fewer. Okay?
Ms. St. John, we have a 5-minute limit, okay. So if we could get you to wrap things up,
okay.
We'd appreciate it. Thank you.
I'll just do one more sentence. I feel it's very unethical, the killing of female cougars at all, because inevitably, I know there's some protection for the kittens, but in the law, but actually many kittens die of starvation, and that makes the killing of cougars altogether unethical. Thank you.
Thank you. I want to say we appreciate you coming from Kanab and sharing that viewpoint. Quite often we don't hear that viewpoint here in the southern region, but when we go to the Wildlife Board meeting, the audience will be full with many people sharing those same opinions. And so I just wanted to point that out. And again, thank you for traveling here today. That's all the comment cards. Did you have a comment for that? Okay. Comments from the rack. Gene?
I want to make one comment, and that's that we need to hear more from the public, the trappers, the houndsmen. Appreciate the lady here making a comment. Other than that, we wouldn't have had any public comments today. And we sure do need to have those comments.
Thank you. It looks like we're ready to entertain a motion if there's no further comments. Come on, Wade.
I don't know why I get bullied into this. Mr. Chairman, I move that we approve the Cougar recommendations as presented.
Do we have a second? Okay, Riley. We have a second from Riley. Any discussion on the motion?
Should have brought this up in the question comp parts, but if we do six archery-only cougar tags on the east side of Salt Lake where you can't release dogs because it's a watershed, how are they going to hunt cougars? Okay, just checking. Yeah. Just checking. All right. Perfect.
What was the answer?
What's that?
It's more than checking.
I just wondered if we want to amend that to say on the archery only unit that if you have a deer tag, it's now a cougar tag.
With the.
Braden
says the non-consumptive. So let me speak up for sportsmen since the non-consumptive made a bizarre recommendation.
Bizarre, crazy.
but I had the same thought. I wrote it down in my notes and I passed it up. I had the same thought. Why on that extended archery? Maybe with your, because that's where we're having some problem cougars. Maybe with your certification to hunt that. Maybe that certification counts as a cougar tag.
Yeah, that would have to go through the legislature. But right. Put it on,
currently it's a...
Maybe that would be my request, is let's put it on the action log to discuss. Because if that's a problem area and we're trying to address it, people aren't going to go buy that tag.
Right. It's harvest objective, so... They may purchase it when they're up there archery hunting. I don't know what people do. We'll see. You're right. It's tough. It's a tough proposition.
Okay. So what I would suggest is we break that up. Let's address the motion and the second that's on the table. If you want to proceed with an additional motion and see how that flies, we can do that. So do we have any further discussion on the main motion? All those in favor? It's unanimous. Okay. Did you want to bring up another motion?
Yeah, I'd like to make a motion that we put it in an action log form to look at a way to somehow allow any extended archery hunter to use his tag on a cougar.
Deer tag.
Deer tag on a cougar. On the Wasatch Front archery only area.
Okay, do we have a second? Can we have a second from Brian? Do we have any discussion? All those in favor? Any opposed? Looks like that is unanimous. Okay, our last action item is the beaver management plan.
Thank you.
last thing on the docket today is a recommendation for a revision of our beaver management plan. Quickly, the first plan was implemented in 2010. The plan calls for a review every 5 years. Obviously, it's been a little bit longer than that. We did begin a review in December of 2016, just kind of go through it. This was a review by our Habitat, Aquatics, and Wildlife sections, in addition to some consultation with USU and some other groups. The reason that we reviewed it and the reason we made some plans is a lot of the goals and objectives had been achieved. And so we wanted to make sure that that was noted and they didn't need to continue forward with that. One of the goals that was achieved was the implementation of a model for beaver habitat across the state. So we wanted to incorporate that model into the new plan for a few reasons. And another thing that we wanted to look at is there's a lot of interest throughout the state and throughout the West in using beavers and specifically their dam building activities to try to rehabilitate riparian corridors where it's appropriate, and I'll explain how we get to that. So let me quickly just talk about this beaver reintroduction analysis tool, or BRAT, is a model that was built at USU in response to an objective in the original plan. And what it does is it uses satellite data to establish suitability in reaches of streams for dam building potential. So it looks at things like woody vegetation, it looks at aspect, it looks at, you know, flood peak and things like that. So the idea is that, you know, are beavers likely, if they aren't there already, are they likely to use the area? And it also can help us find places or classify places as suitable for translocation if we wanted to use that as a tool to rehabilitate a stream. It also has a very conservative component that looks at the likelihood of human conflict. And so it overestimates, if anything, the potential for human conflict. And that flags areas for us to look at. Either we don't want to have beavers in that system, or if we do, we want to make sure that we are consulting with all the stakeholders and working through that with a plan. So it's a GIS layer model. GIS stands for Geographic Information Systems, and what it does is it uses satellite data and kind of piles layers up to inform our decisions, to help us manage, and to look at data spatially on the landscape. So here's an example of some output. This is from northern Utah, but the model covers the whole state. This is up by Logan. It's the Spawn Creek drainage. And the different colors that you can see on the map represent different habitat suitability indexes. The ones on this map that are the most permanent are most pertinent are the green ones. In the model, we call those low-hanging fruit. In other words, all the components exist that beavers, if they don't exist there already and you put them there, they should do well. They've got woody vegetation. They're not going to get, the dams aren't going to get blown out likely. But on top of that, if you see that red pop up, that's our human conflict portion of the model. And so if you look at the blue areas, for example, that's another area that might be suitable for beavers. But the model says there could be a problem here. It's too close to a road. In this example, I think there's a trail. It's too close to irrigation. It's on private property. There are a lot of different components in there. What that would do for us is warn us that we need to do some homework on that, and if we need to get on the ground, look at the area, establish whether there is a conflict there or not. If there's not, then maybe we proceed. If there is, we either work through it with the stakeholders, or we don't have beavers there. Some people have asked why we would want to move beavers around at all. They do have, again, their dam building activity does provide a lot of benefits in these riparian these river systems. It can do a lot of things. It can raise the overall water table. It can eliminate cut banks by sediments building up. It actually can raise over time the stream bed and reconnect it with the floodplain, so you get more of a natural system. Those floodplains can provide increased big game and livestock grazing. It can create more beneficial fish habitat, just more species overall, a little bit more of a diverse suite of species use those areas. And it can help with silt retention and flood control in some systems. One other thing the plan specifies is that if we're going to move these animals around, we need to be really careful about moving undesirable invasive species with them, whirling disease, things like that. So what the plan says is that if we know that we have animals in a contaminated water system, we can move them, but they can only go to another system that's already got that. Whether it's whirling disease or whatever in it, they can't go somewhere else. If they're in waters without any concerns, they can be moved. As long as the model says it's appropriate, they can be moved anywhere else within the state. Finally, animals that we're not sure about the status of AIS, they need to undergo a 72-hour quarantine in a facility before they can be released, so they can be cleaned, they can pass any kind of contaminants in their gut, that kind of thing. This is actually our southern region quarantine facility picture here. So we have those facilities available down here already. So quickly, just to kind of cover it all, we want to use this model to make decisions about where beavers are, to try to quantify the animals that we have, areas that are appropriate, areas that may need additional work. We also want to use it to identify habitat restoration areas. The plan also guides us to avoid potential conflict. There's a planning process that's called for. We have to consult with stakeholders, whether that's county governments, private landowners, land management agencies, those types of things, if we want to undertake these activities. It allows beavers that we may be having problems with in one part of the state. They're living in a irrigation system or something like that. Right now, we typically take them lethally, but we could use those as potential transplant beavers. The old plan carved out areas in the state and tried to identify subspecies, but the latest information that we can find is that beavers in North America are all the same species. They're all North American beavers. There's not a lot of strong evidence for subspecies, so we're not going to, we can move one beaver to another place in the new plan. And again, the quarantine is required to move, avoid moving diseases around. And that's it.
Okay. Any questions from the RAC? Riley?
Just one. With the proposal, would there be any way to limit take once you do the you move them? I mean, is there going to be a way to regulate that as well? Because it would be pretty awful to get them established after a year and then have somebody like me come in and get rid of them for you.
Yeah, and that exists under our current rule, so that would remain in place. And typically, you'd want to do that to give them a chance to establish, and then close those areas for a certain amount of time.
Is it a time? time limit right now? Well, I'm not familiar with that. I should be. 3 years?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Anybody else? Okay, Verla.
So when you look at this plan and you get response from, like, the landowner or the owner of the irrigation rights to that stream, how much do you take that into account? Is that in high on your list, or?
Yeah, that human conflict model is pretty conservative. So it looks at proximity to private land and agriculture and things like that. So it errs on the side of kicking stuff out, even if it maybe is okay. So also, you know, we rely on our local folks. They know who's in that drainage. They know who that's likely to affect, and they need to be talking to all those folks if they're going to try and put a project together. And the plan says that's the part of the planning process you've got to go through to make, before you start moving animals around, you need to make sure everybody is in the loop, everybody understands what you're planning on doing, and if, you know, if it's not going to work and people have concerns, we just won't do it.
Okay, yeah, because on an irrigation system, beavers don't work. They're just trashy, and it's not good.
Yeah, Berlin, in general, what we're doing is we're taking beavers from those sorts of situations where they're down in irrigation ditches and they're causing problems, and we're moving them high up into the drainage where they're doing some good, where they're making it so when the snow melts, it's not just like flushing the toilet. We get a release throughout the summer, and increasing those water tables, and that benefits everybody.
Okay. Any other questions, comments? I don't have any comment cards. Did I ask for questions from the audience? It's getting late. Okay. I think we're ready for...
We still have Miss St. Joan here.
Yeah, she... We're ready for a motion. Craig?
I'll make a motion we accept the beaver management plan.
Do we have a second? Okay, a second from Rusty. All those in favor? Looks unanimous.
I appreciate everybody's time. That was a marathon. Thanks for keeping me on my toes, too. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks. Last item is number 11. I just want to make sure that everybody's aware of the August 30th training meeting. You should all received an email from that. It is open to all the RAC members, and especially those that are just new with the RAC. But if you're already a member or have been for and you'd like to go, you're invited as well. Did you want to add to that, Kevin?
Yeah, as much as we can make something required for volunteer advisory council members, it's required for the new ones and optional for everybody else if you want a refresher.
Well, that's tentative. Watch your emails on the next RAC meeting.
Can I ask a question before we get to that?
Yeah.
Just a question. On the board meeting, they're going to go over the expo permits and that. How come that's not in front of the RACs?
Because according to that rule, it's just something that the board does.
Just they do. Okay. That's fine. I'm just curious.
That's the way it's always been. In regards to the September RAC meeting, September is normally our fishing rules and regulations. If you remember last year, we passed a two-year fishing proclamation. So right now, there isn't anything. There are no action items for the September RAC meeting. There are a couple potentials, but as of right now, that RAC meeting will likely be canceled. We'll let you know for sure.
That's all I have, so we'll call this meeting adjourned.